independent, yours. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, as the appalling situation in Palestine worsens, populations in countries around the world are demanding a stop to Israel's grotesque violation of international human rights laws. But where it counts in the UN Security Council, there's been no action since the bloody assault against Gaza's captive populations began. Yesterday, even Russia's anodyne resolution to condemn the violence was vetoed by the council with no other motions proposed. John Helmer is a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia, principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears. Helmer has too been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, and served as advisor to governments at the highest levels. Among his many book titles are Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Jackal's Wedding, American Power, Arab Revolt, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, and his latest SOVCOM plot, How Pirates Tried to Capture the Treasure of the Russian Seas and Were Caught Out. John's latest article at Dances with Bears is White Flag in a Black Hole. Is Russian neutrality a force or a trade? Welcome back to the show, John.
Thank you for having me, Chris. Thanks.
Well, it's always a pleasure. We just talked last week about this, and it's gotten so much worse since then. How much more terrible this week has become, and how much more terrible will next week become, is anybody's guess. John, your article suggests Russia's longstanding do-little policy on Palestine, Israel, is becoming now a do-nothing quid pro quo understanding as regards Ukraine. Am I reading that right?
Yes and no, Chris. It's very complicated, and we have been seeing immense change since you and I spoke to the Guerrilla Radio audience, the only intelligent audience left on the public radio since last week. In fact, overnight, where I am, but over your afternoon, there's been action in the Security Council in New York and action in Beijing, where President Putin has given a press conference. So let me go to the yes, you're right, not quite. saying the right thing and doing nothing could be and maybe is a major Kremlin deception of the West to be followed by real action on the ground with Russian support, or else it's a grand Kremlin deception of the Russian army, the Russian people, and allies against the U.S.-Israeli alliance here. Between saying the right thing and doing nothing, there are a lot of cups and there are a lot of lips, and there's a lot of us slipping between the cups and the lips. We can go into the details now. On the one hand, what has just happened this afternoon, New York time, is that the, as you said in the intro, the U.S. vetoed every attempt to put a restriction on Israeli army attacking Palestine in Gaza or the West Bank. No restriction by the is the U.S. policy for Israeli attack. Okay. Second, Russia did everything possible in the UN Security Council, starting with its resolution on Monday and its amended resolution today, to introduce a concept of immediate ceasefire, one. Two, condemnation of unrestricted military action against civilians and civilian objects in the Gaza. Those two provisions did not name Israel. They did not name Hamas. They enunciated the general principles. They were supported by Russia, China, and some other states, but defeated by the U.S. veto on both resolutions and by the abstentions of the U.K. and the European Union countries. Then what happened was that the Brazilian resolution which was a watered down calling for humanitarian pauses to let goods come into medications and hospital treatments and so forth, coming into the territory from outside, from Egypt. That resolution was vetoed by the United States also. So what's happened is the US is doing nothing to stop Israeli attacks, indiscriminate attacks on the hospital. Al-Aqsa is only one of them, the disastrous one of the other night. And I might point out that Mr. Nebenzia, the Russian representative at the UN, referred to that as an airstrike. An airstrike. That means an airdropped guided bomb destroyed the hospital, killing more than 500 people and wounding more than 1,000. He did not refer to it as a Hamas rocket strike. And we can come back to what's the difference and the cover-up that the United States, including President Biden, have implemented. On the other hand, President Putin, in a press conference in Beijing, following his meetings there, said little and indicated only that the Russia will do one thing. Let me come to that. On the one hand, President Putin has been met privately as well as in delegation for several hours in Beijing and admitted that there have been 3 hours of conversation with President Xi. Although the Russian side has portrayed the conversations as amiable and constructive, the fact is there is not, what's missing is any sign of a joint Chinese-Russian humanitarian aid program for the Gaza. No sign that they reached any agreement on joint and coordinated policy for humanitarian purposes in the Gaza. That's a failure. That's a do nothing. On the other hand, the one thing that President Putin said he was doing was to order the into the air for a permanent patrol, MiG-31s, armed with Kinjal missiles, though to the southernmost limit of the Black Sea. Too bad we don't have maps that fix to your ears on the radio, but basically that means that brings the Kinjal within range of the U.S. fleet off the southwestern coast of Cyprus, threatening Lebanon and threatening intervention against Palestine. So basically, although President Putin said this is not a threat, of course it is a threat. It's a response to the U.S. threat to send Marines, to send a second aircraft carrier, the Eisenhower, to join the USS Gerald Ford, and the increased U.S. air armament at fields in Jordan. So what President Putin said is a response to the U.S. intervention on behalf of Israel at sea. Now, what does that mean for Russian, Chinese, and Arab coordination to get humanitarian convoys into Israel? That's something we need to talk about soon, because that's the do-nothing part. At this moment, there have also been some indications, some unusual meetings at the Russian Foreign Ministry during the afternoon of today, Russian time, that Egypt is discussing humanitarian aid convoying with Russia, which would be protected by Russian forces, the National Guard, commanded by Viktor Zolotov. We can come back to those details in a minute. You will see none of that, none of it, in the Western press. Instead, banner headline, for example, on the part of the Financial Times, the Japanese mouth organ in London, the Israelis have agreed that with President Biden that they will not prevent humanitarian assistance from Egypt, and I'm quoting, as long as it's only food, water, and medicine for the civilian population located in the southern Gaza Strip or those evacuating there, and as long as these supplies do not reach Hamas. That's the FT London quoting Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel. Now, what that really means is exactly what the two UN officials have been trying to achieve. The Israeli-American idea, fostered by Secretary General Guterres and Deputy Secretary General Martin Griffiths, that the Israel will dictate that civilians must evacuate Gaza City in order to receive any aid from outside. They must go to, quote, safe zones, a term that Secretary of State Blinken has been using, evacuate to those points. And maybe the Israelis won't attack those safe points, though they've been attacking refugee columns moving south. They've been attacking the Rafah border crossing. In other words, it's what I would like to call the Wehrmacht SS terms to the Warsaw Ghetto, when the Warsaw Ghetto during the last stages of World War II rebelled. Either we will give you evacuation to safety where you'll die, or you'll stay there and you'll die. Both of those alternatives, let's call them the Warsaw Ghetto alternatives, are what the UN, the US, and Israel have dictated as their terms for humanitarian aid. Now, that means do nothing for the Palestinians on the Israeli-American side.
Yeah, well, the Americans made that clear, as you said, at the Security Council. On the face of it, their veto was ostensibly because the Brazilian resolution, the way I was paying attention to it, didn't include a condemnation of Hamas and the reiteration of the often heard trope that Israel has the right to self-defense, which is taken as a shorthand for meaning that anything Israel does in response to attacks or perceived attacks is legitimate, despite international law that clearly lays out that it isn't. This idea that you mentioned, John, is really fascinating, and I've been watching a ton of coverage, and I haven't heard this about this Egyptian-Russian coordination of aid at Rafah. You did mention, though, that they're bombing. Israel has bombed the Rafah, the route to from the Rafah crossing into Egypt, to the single road that leads up. It runs the length of the strip, and that they would be protected by Russian troops. Is that so? How would that work? And what would Russia do? I'm certain Israel wouldn't allow Russians to be tromping up into Gaza, especially armed ones.
Let's go back two bits. Let me just say a couple of introductory remarks about the so-called international humanitarian law regarding self-defense. Okay. I can certainly recommend to everybody listening that they follow some recent writing by Jonathan Cook. Jonathan Cook has reported in a variety of media from inside Palestine for many, many years. He's got a couple of pieces out at the moment in antiwar.com and dissidentvoice.com, and he spells out the context leading up to the present situation, letting it be very clear the extent of Israeli attacks on civilians and civilian objects that preceded by years and by hundreds and thousands of deaths, the October 7 attack by Hamas. Now, in international humanitarian law, and I don't recommend you try the British lawyer calling himself the Undersecretary for Refugees, Martin Griffiths. He is a liar and a manipulator of international humanitarian law on behalf of the UN, in behalf of Israel and the United States, in depicting that what has happened began on October 7. It did not begin on October 7. And the right of self-defense of civilians under attack in Palestine includes the same right of self-defense, violence, or armed force that the UN peacekeepers have adopted for years. That is, you can defend yourself with violence proportional to the violence used against you. So if Griffiths, Gutierrez, the Americans and the Israelis start this affair on October 7 when Hamas attacked Israel, they are lying and deceiving and illegalizing the entire structure of international law that applies here. Self-defense applies to the Palestinians. Hamas is the legal, legitimate, democratically elected government of Gaza. It attacked in self-defense under international humanitarian law. Now, plenty of listeners might find that surprising from a legal point of view. So we'll have maybe time some other time to go into the legal issues, but you want to understand the facts, the evidence leading to the legal interpretation. Start with Jonathan Cook. Don't start with Martin Griffiths. That's where we are. Hamas acted as the government of a state, a statelet, occupied illegally to defend itself with force proportional to the force used against it prior to October 7. However, the force used against Hamas and Palestine, Gaza, is disproportional, and the US, the UN, and Israel have been using it, and the abuse became visible to everybody with the attack on the Gaza hospital. Now, let's go to the question, the particular question you raised, of what can Russia and what will Russia do? I'll go backwards and forwards, and I hope it's not confusing to anyone. The situation is that the only meeting that President Putin has convened of senior officials is not the Security Council, which is the designated body that reviews as a collective, and Russia is governed by a collective. For those of you who listen to the media depicting it as a one-man, one-armed country, they're wrong. The Security Council has not met since October the 3rd. But this week, President Putin, before he left for China, reviewed the Gaza-Palestine issue with an operational group. Unusually, very unusually, there were two individuals representing the military. One was Defense Minister Shoigu in civilian togs. The second was Viktor Zolotov in military costume. Zolotov is the head of the National Guard. He has had a long, long history of personal association with President Putin and was his bodyguard. He has graduated from being bodyguard to the president of Russia, to the interior minister, deputy interior minister in charge of internal troops. And those internal troops were renamed the National Guard in 2015-2016. The National Guard under Zolotov has basically developed since 2016. And at that point, Zolotov got a seat on the Security Council, except he's never sat in it publicly, except for one session just before the beginning of the special military operation. This is easier to read, perhaps, than to listen, but I'm trying to compress what's happening. Why was Zolotov in that meeting? Why wasn't General Gerasimov, head of the General Staff? Why was the only person wearing a military uniform at that session Zolotov? Answer, because Zolotov's National Guard has the detailed experience of running convoys in the Donbas under Ukraine fire, and it has the experience of guarding military installations and civilian installations and pipelines and roads and infrastructure in Syria, in support of the Syrian government and in support of the Russian military missions and bases in Syria. So Zolotov was there, not because he's an intellectual, he's not. He was there to reflect the National Guard. And the National Guard is Russia's most experienced force for running and protecting convoys of humanitarian quality and military and civilian infrastructure. So I interpret, I might be quite wrong, call in and tell me I'm basically wrong if you got better evidence than I've got. However, I'd say starting at the beginning of this week, before the attack on the Gaza hospital, Russia was thinking of how to implement humanitarian aid and how to protect the convoys. Zolotov would protect the convoy if there's enough agreement for the supplier of the aid and the means of delivering it by land through Egypt, by sea from Egypt north, or from Turkey south.
Okay, so my question, I don't feel it's been answered, though. So
where are we right now?
Well, yeah, what would Israel do faced with such a thing should it come? And keeping in mind that the clock is ticking every moment is vital, you know.
Well, you're quite right. The gap between my lip and my cup is pretty considerable. Why here? Because, as we spelled out a minute ago, Netanyahu's terms are, we won't allow any convoy in unless it goes to the so-called safe zones, and we will inspect. We won't allow any interference with our inspection, and it must go through one land corridor. In other words, Israel is saying we will empty Gaza City. You will not be able to get water in that place. We will destroy that place because we will allegedly be hitting Hamas. So it's basically Israel and the Americans are threatening any convoy that doesn't meet their conditions. You're right. Second, Russia doesn't want a direct military confrontation between the convoys and their protective screen. So the problem that it appears, the Egyptian ambassador went in to see the deputy foreign minister in the foreign ministry in Moscow late today. The issue was, what can Egypt assemble with Russian military cover to deter an Israeli attack and any attempt by the Americans offshore to protect Israel while they attacked Russians or the convoy. We are therefore at the point, nobody's talking about it except us, that to get aid in on Israeli terms means capitulation for civilians and the destruction of Gaza City and Hamas. A convoy on Egyptian, Arab, Russian terms would be a challenge to the Americans and the Israelis. President Putin has said, if you so much as fire anything from the Gerald Ford squadron, you will draw a Kinjal response from us in the Black Sea. Those missiles, supersonic, cannot be defended by the Americans. That's been proved in the Ukraine. So if you want to see an aircraft carrier go down, and there hasn't been a case of that since kamikaze attacks sank the USS Bismarck Sea, February 1945, Putin is saying, don't attack from those locations. We will respond. So I'm exaggerating, maybe. I'm misrepresenting the facts. However, all I've got to go on are the facts I've just presented. So you're quite right, Chris, to ask the question and say, I haven't answered it, because we've reached a higher level of escalation now because the UN refused to agree under a US veto on any other alternative. So what do we face? Say the right things. We've done all that. What can be done other than nothing to let more than a million people die under Israeli-American attack, what can be done? It's not nothing. And we haven't yet talked about what the Iranians propose to do.
Yeah. Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm talking today with John Helmer. John's a journalist and author. He spent decades living and reporting from Russia, and he's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears. His latest article at Dances with Bears is White Flag in a Black Hole. Is Russian neutrality a force or a trade? Yeah, the idea that earlier, I don't know if it was 2 days ago, it's all becoming a bit of a blur, but there was a request, and I'm not sure at what level, that Egypt agree to take a humanitarian stream of refugees leaving Gaza, and they refused to do that. They refused to open the Rafah border to do that, knowing that they would be used as a convenient holding area for the depopulation or ethnic cleansing of Gaza, and quite rightly, they don't want to do that. It would seem to me that the only deal that they can strike, and this is Israel's ace in the hole, is that if they want to allow humanitarian convoys to travel north into Gaza with supplies for the increasingly desperate people there, the quid pro quo is that there's a reciprocal traffic of people out of the country and into Gaza, for which America and other allies of Russia with deep pockets, presumably, would pay and set up some kind of situation, as we've seen in Turkey, for the Syrian refugees. Does that sound logical?
Well, it's logical. The situation's very clear, and it's been U.S. presidential policy since February 1945. Franklin Roosevelt met with King Abdulaziz of Saudi Arabia and offered to bribe him if he would agree, if the Arabs would agree to the evacuation from Palestine of the Arab population so that the Jews could move in and establish a Jewish state. A Zionist state. That was Roosevelt's position in 45. It hasn't changed. February 45 is 3 years before Israel becomes more than a twinkle in a Zionist eye, and 4 years before the Israeli army destroys the Arabs and begins effectively the political and military state and military occupation of Palestine. So it's not new that Israeli-American, or should I say American-Israeli policy, is to empty Palestine of all Arabs. And when Prime Minister Netanyahu went and spoke to an empty chamber of the UN back in September, he proposed a map of the, quotes, new Middle East. That's according to Israel and the United States. And on that map, and I published it in the lead to the article you mentioned, you can see Israel in blue. That's the Zionist state emptied of all its Arabs. The blue includes Gaza. The blue includes the Golan, Syrian Golan, and it includes the West Bank. Now, that's the way Netanyahu depicted his country. It's the way the Israeli constitution, the basic law, depicts the formula for Israel to be a Jewish state in which the only right to liberation, self-realization, human right is first the Jewish people, not the Arabs. So it's not exactly an ace in the hole, to use your phrase, Chris. The Israelis have been attempting to do this for a very long time. The question then is, who is strong enough, whose force is strong enough to prevent it? Well, the answer is a combination of Arab and Iranian states might constitute, with outside support, enough of a deterrent to protect what's left of Arab Palestine. So what we have isn't an ace in the hole. We've got a poker game, a very dangerous poker game, in which the Russian side And I have to point out to everybody, I speak from the Russian perspective, not because I'm agreeing to that perspective, because that's the one about which I have the most evidence. It's the place and the